My name is Alfred. I'm here with my friends Jonathan, Tom, and Joe. We're here to talk about aliens today on Hollywood Boulevard.
Listening to the Hollywood Boulevard podcast.
Hello.
Hey, what's going on, Alfred?
Not much. I'm just chilling in my house in Virginia, where I got my name on the list to get vaccinated, so that's good. And we're here to talk aliens, and which was a sequel to the Ridley Scott film, came out in the late 70s. And I didn't get to see Alien until much later, because when we went to see it, I got pissed off because my dad and my uncle, I was visiting my grandparents in Massachusetts, and my dad and my uncle went to go see Alien, and I went to go see Moonraker with my mom and my grandparents. And so I missed out on that, but they said they came out of there terrified. They're like, what did we just watch? And yeah. I saw the chest burster scene. One of my friends had it on VHS, and that was the only scene I really saw the movie until I saw the full thing, I think right before we went to see Alien in 1986. Oh, and we saw it at the Beachmont Theater in Newport News, which is an old-timey theater that with the rocking seats and the kind of almost like a stage. And right. Coming out of that, my life had changed. It's almost like a Star Wars Empire moment when I came out of the Marines and stuff. So that's where my first experience seeing the movie was, in the theater in 1986 with my uncle, my dad, my friend Brian, and a couple other kids. But back then, I don't think they checked IDs as much as they do now.
No, I remember you could sit in the theater and they didn't really even clear the theater. You could just sit there and watch it again.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And they're like, yeah, go ahead. I'll lift my feet up. You can get the popcorn and I'm just going to stay here. Oh, go ahead. Stay. Yeah.
So Tom, what was how'd you see it for the first time?
I saw it in the theater. I was still living in Virginia. I saw it. It wasn't at Springfield Mall. It was somewhere. It was another theater, and I went with my friend Lee, and you know, I was in high school at the time, and I remember watching it and experiencing the movie, and it was such an intense experience and such a mind twist that you could be in a war movie that was also a science fiction movie that, you know, was not a sequel that just retread what the first one did, but rather took the premise and put an entirely different contextualization on it. It's like, mm-hmm. It was much more of like a, well, what is the logical extension? And by extension, it changed the genre to more of a war movie kind of thing. And what impressed me the most about the film was how lived in everything felt. Like it felt like all the tech in the film felt like the same company made it. You know, that was like, that's Weyland-Yutani. That the ship looks right. That this looks right. The way the aliens moved in it was a very kind of nerve jangling way. You know, Cameron's pacing was so brilliant. I remember going, you know, out of the theater, and you know, when you've seen a really good movie, you feel like you're still living it. Like minutes after you walk out of the movie, you're like, I'm still a Marine. I'm still here. They could come anywhere. They could be in the ceiling, you know? And I went to Roy Rogers Restaurant. I don't know if you guys remember that. It was a fast food restaurant where you could pick your own toppings. And I stood there shell-shocked with my friend Lee. We didn't say a word for about half an hour because we were both kind of processing. And we sat down and I just remember looking at him and I was like, so what'd you think? And he goes, wow. It's like, we need to go see that again. So we left Roy Rogers and went to go see the movie again. Nice. Because it's like a roller coaster. You want to get back on the roller coaster to see if you could experience the same stuff. And I actually, to Cameron's credit, I appreciated different things the second time I saw it on the same day than I did the first time, because I noticed little details, little filigree that he put into it, little things he lavished into it that I was like, oh, that's like, I didn't realize, like, you know, the names on the videos and what people were saying in other conversations and everything. Mm-hmm. So that was my experience of it, was pure shell shock, and realizing the power of what you could do with a sequel. It's still to this day, I think, one of the best sequels to any film ever made.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely one of the top five sequels, at least, if not even right at the top. So So for me,
What was your experience?
For me, it was kind of interesting. I saw part two before I saw part one. So it was inverted. I was working at Wendy's. This is like in 88. So I didn't see it first run in the theaters or anything. So I was working at Wendy's and all, and one of my buddies there was like, this movie, it's come out on video. I've already seen it in the theaters. He's like, gotta watch it with me. So he got it at the video store and we watched it on VHS and all. And it was, definitely changed within a year. I was working at Blockbuster, and it just completely, it was one of the things that just elevated my love of the movie and stuff like that. And to your point about it being one of the best sequels, I mean, it's up there with the best sci-fi movies, just sequel or not. I mean, in general, it's one of the best, because it had really, what you were talking about, but also the humor. There was some humor in it with the Paxton that I thought was, and I mean, sometimes it'd be considered overdone, but I mean, for him,
he was great.
Perfect.
We're on an elevator to hell going down.
He says,
put him in charge.
He says, if you haven't been keeping up with current events,
it was such a great character. He's such a good actor that putting someone with that skill in that kind of supporting role was genius.
I wrote the line, "Yo, stop your grinning and drop your linen." Found him.
Yeah.
Stop your grinning and drop your. You know, they trained with actual Marines to get that way. Did you know that? He put him through a whole Marine training thing.
I'm not surprised.
You know? Yeah, Cameron wanted him to like really know what it was like, and that's where they picked up phrases like that. You know, it's just great.
You talk about the opening. The express elevator going to hell, like my friend and I, we had season passes to Busch Gardens, and every time the Loch Ness Monster peaked at the top, we'd yell, "Express elevator to hell, going down."
What are you going to say, Joe?
Go ahead. I'll catch up on it later. I'm going to talk about how you saw it first. You're the youngest one, I guess.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, I'm the baby. And yeah, I mean, when it came out in 1986, I think, or whatever, I was 4 years old, so I did not see this in the theater, nor did I really see it like, because I guess growing up, I was allowed to watch some rated R movies. Like the second rated R movie I was allowed to ever watch was Terminator 2. You know,
okay.
The first one was RoboCop.
That's full immersion into R.
I'm surprised. like looking back at it, it's like so fucking bloody, but like, you know, and nasty. But like, I think my dad always found it to be like sort of like comic-y, you know, like it was like a comic book, you know, or whatever. And so it's not real, you know, it's not.
That's a harsh one. Yeah.
So
from Archie to RoboCop,
he liked Terminator 2 better than Terminator 1 for me to watch. He wouldn't let me watch Terminator 1 until I was like 16 or so, or 17.
Is that a sex scene in it?
That was not it. It was the guy ripping or Arnold Schwarzenegger ripping the guy's heart out. He just found it to be too like nasty and mean,
too visceral,
too mean spirited, I guess was the word. And so I wasn't allowed to watch it till I was like, I guess 17 or 18 or whatever. He made me read the whole book of Clockwork Orange before I watched the movie when I was in high school, and I fucking loved it. I loved the book so much. I was like, okay, now I can watch the movie, okay? Because like I feel like I already saw it in my head, you know?
Right. Interesting. Your dad's an interesting character.
Yeah, he is. But Aliens. So I watched it, like I got it on Blu-ray years whatever, because I was like, well, I'm gonna buy a couple of the Aliens movies. Like, I watched at least the first two, you know. And so I watched the first movie, and honestly, everybody knows this about me, or most people know this about me, but I don't like movies where they're like trapped in one location and everything. Kind of, I don't like feeling claustrophobic, and I don't like I get kind of bored when a lot of it's none of the action's happening. That was not the case with this movie, for sure.
Yeah.
So I enjoy Aliens a lot more than Alien. But I respect Alien a lot, because if it weren't for Aliens, wouldn't exist.
And yeah. also Alien redefined how you could make science fiction look, and also it redefined horror in general. With a kind of high tech, I mean, Ridley Scott's visual aesthetic, you know, horror films weren't typically beautiful. And so the profane look of the alien and all the creepiness of it mashed with those beautiful shots that he would do where it was painterly and yet you were creeped out. That was something that no one had seen before. We kind of take it for granted, but there are movies before Alien and there are movies after Alien, and everyone can begin with Alien as far as a look, because when you were making a horror film, you might be Hammer, you know, might have influenced you, the Hammer films, or you would have had the grindhouse look or different things like that. But Alien took an art house approach to horror and transplanted it to science fiction. And you really wouldn't have seen any of those movies after Alien had he not been able to marry his visual aesthetic to that kind of high-tech gothic creepiness that Alien had. And what an amazing thing. I was reading that... is it Jedworski, the guy who was going to do Dune in the 70s? Yeah. He's the one. He brought H.R. Giger. He brought the guys who designed the ships, Ron Cobb and all of them. He brought them to Hollywood. And when his film fell apart, Ridley scooped them all up and said, I'm going to make Alien with them. So had Dune not failed in the 70s, you never would have had the look of Alien in 1979. So we can owe that to the first iteration of Dune that Alien was even able to be made.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool how organically it fell together, where the right people were together with a new way of seeing the world and then creating a horror like a haunted house on a spaceship, but then creating these biomechanical creatures and things that felt more real. And then it was so beautiful that you kind of let your guard down. You're like, wow, that's a beautiful shot of that, or that's beautiful. Oh, wait, okay, now it's on his face. You know, and then you do all this, and then and you don't associate beauty like that with horror. So it was kind of a nice demarcation of genre. And then it led to Aliens, which you don't think of war movies as science fiction.
Yeah. I liked how and they did an Alien as well, where they sort of just went around the ship when they were all still sleeping. And just the slow, it made you feel really like the lived in thing, but also just the whole, just showing you what you were about to embrace later on.
Yes.
And then I think this had one of the best sound. I mean, the scores. I mean, the score was simply phenomenal. I mean, just the noises,
that horn that goes through. You know, that was the first time Horner worked with Cameron, I believe. And he had 3 weeks to do the music soundtrack. 3 weeks.
Yeah, because I think I read that it was finished like a week before it got released in the theaters.
And he had 3 weeks to score it with an orchestra. I mean, wow. And he came up with that crazy. He had 3 weeks to write the score and six weeks total to deliver it.
Now, so, and thinking back then, too, they would have to print. I mean, to make all the prints too, because now it's digital. You could, but I mean, they'd have to go through the production of all the prints, the studios, and all that stuff, and get it all. Shipped out to all the different locations. I'm sure that was probably pretty stressful.
You can't just pop the movie in your TV and watch it and score to it. He had to go to a scoring stage at midnight and sit there and go, okay, I need to write music cues for the last 20 minutes of this film, and I have to do it tonight because I don't have a movie projector. And you have an appreciation for how much he had to do. And he did get an Oscar nomination, if I'm not mistaken, for that score. Because you said, it's so evocative. It's almost like the score was part of the sound effects.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was very integral.
And I think there was it was up for like 7 awards. And I think it won a couple.
Well deserved.
And I mean, and it also Weaver got nominated for she's like the first female action star that got nominated.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she totally deserved cheated. It was a very strong. I don't remember who won, actually.
'86.
We'd have to look it up. I don't know, Jonathan, if you know.
I'm thinking '86.
Forgot that she was nominated for that.
That'd be like I think it's great. Or something. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Amadeus may have been '84, but maybe '86. I don't know.
Somewhere in that area, that vicinity.
Yeah.
But it won for set decorate. I mean, which it should have.
Because
it was just phenomenal. I mean, I think Horner got nominated, and it had a few other nominations as well. But definitely something to behold there. And so So you guys, in mind, our first inclination viewing of it was with the original version, not like the extended version and stuff like that.
Right.
I have a good segue into the extended version.
Okay. I want to say, then we'll let you, Moody, was your first version you got to see, was it the extended or was it just the regular version?
The original. Was
the original.
First,
okay. So we all saw the original.
Yeah.
Cause there's a big thing that I'd like to talk about on that, but I'll go ahead, Alfred.
Yeah. So, after we saw the movie, I used to read a lot more books then than I do now, but we couldn't have the movie right away like we do now with a DVD within 2 weeks. So you had to read the book or something to relive it. So reading the book, they had all these scenes in there. I was like, man, this would be so cool, especially the sentry guns, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, these are badass. And I have my friend read the book. And then So I was like, how do you make a good movie better? Well, James Cameron, I think he did the first director's cut that I know of on record. And when he released that, it was only available on Laserdisc for like $100. So right. I went to Circuit City in 1991. It took me a couple months to pay for it, but I bought a Laserdisc player and the $125 constant angular velocity Laserdisc special edition of Alien, so I could watch those like 15 or 20 minutes of scenes. And that was totally a life changer for me. That was so incredible. I still have the Laserdisc player and the Laserdisc, and they still work.
So you bought a whole new format. You bought a whole new like a system just for eight. That's saying something about it. That's saying something.
You didn't have YouTube back then. You had to
buy a new system. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, you know what? Don't you think it added a nice little symmetry to it though? That the director's cut had Sigourney Weaver's character Ripley losing her own daughter much more prominently on the space station, like finding out, oh man, I missed her life. You know, I missed her growing up. I missed everything because I was in cryosleep. And then finding Newt has a lot more resolution of why she like clamps onto her so much, because she is literally a second chance to be a mom, you know, for her. And I feel like that gave an extra resonance that wasn't there. It's like, of course she cared about her as a human being. You know, if there's a mothering instinct, any parent would have, a man or a woman finding this poor girl. But the resonance of her going, I miss my own daughter's life, having that on the space station and seeing that old picture of her own kid made me go, oh, I get there's like an even deeper resonance to why she will not give up on Newt.
And I think that was actually, I think that was a picture of her mom that they used for that too.
It probably was.
But yeah. I think one thing I really wish, now seeing it with the extended version all the time, it's like, okay, I'm so used to it being part of it, but I think that was a cut that they probably shouldn't have taken out of it. I mean, that one little segment was so phenomenal, because it did bring a lot to the emotional impact of her desire to save Newt and all that. So I really wish they would have had that in the original. The whole stuff with the at the site where Newt was a kid and growing up and stuff like that. That part, I kind of liked that it wasn't in the original, because it left so much mystery when they were going to that going there.
Yeah, like, you don't having know what seen it, you, yeah, I agree with you. I would remove that part.
Yeah,
because I want to discover with the Marines the space rather than feel exactly. like, oh yeah, I remember this place. Exactly. But I would have left some of the other stuff, like the sentry gun stuff is fantastic, and I would have definitely left in the thing about the mother, you know, her being a mother and everything. I think. From what I've read, Fox basically said it needs to be this many minutes, and they just took a chopping block. And he's like, "Well, then I'm going to have to chop something."
Yeah, and another line that they added in the extended that wasn't in the original was the where they traded first names.
Yes,
with Michael Biehn's character, and I was like, that just showed that their relationship was evolving through the entire movie. But it became a friendship. It was more than just. Trying to survive. They were bonded together.
They were bonding, and it did give it a more emotional, a little more weight. And those little grace notes are what make films even better, because you start to see little layers and things. So it would have been nice if they, you know, remember though, in the 80s, the studios were like, nah, we need to run it, you know, 10 times a day. So you need to cut this, you know, there's nowhere else it's going to be. So thank goodness home video came around where you could see other versions of the film, because I have both, and sometimes I'll watch both.
Laserdisc at one point was like the big thing, right? Like you could watch it, like all of a sudden, like all these really cool things that you weren't able to get and you could appreciate are there. Then yeah. all of a sudden now, I think we do really kind of like we live in a time where we kind of take everything for granted because like we have all of these things, like, you know, even more, you know, like what else can you do? You know, like, I don't, like when people do like 8K and 12K and 2000K, what is like, you know, what is like, what's going to be it? You know, like, I mean,
when something reaches out to TV and smacks you in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. Full immersion.
Like that.
You'll like actually die at the end of the movie. That would be full immersion.
What was that? Was it the scene in Back to the Future 2 where the shark comes at him?
Yeah.
He's like, that shark still looks fake.
He still looks fake.
Yeah.
That was Jaws great. 19. Satire. Yeah. Jaws 19. That's right. The other thing I was going to say real quick before we move on is the Laserdisc was the first time I heard commentary tracks.
Yes.
You were able to, it's almost as if you were sitting next to the people that were making it in the theater and they would tell you stories about how it was made or anything. And I think for somebody that's really a fan of something, what a cool way to have an insight, to appreciate it from someone else's point of view, to sit with someone and have them tell stories about it. It richened it up. You know, if you could do that with books, it'd be like, how amazing it would be to sit down with Mark Twain. It's like, what were you thinking when you wrote this line when you did it? I love that about laser discs. And you miss that in streaming, of course, because you don't have additional audio tracks. So you can't necessarily hear what the thought process was for some of the people that created it. So the beauty of having a laser disc, even if you had to flip it over in the middle of the film, was you could play an audio track and you had an expert sitting next to you telling secrets,
right?
Yeah, it's registered for all time. It's like you have like a historical track for them and stuff like that. So it's like once they're when they're gone and stuff like that, you'll have something that'll always be identifiable to that.
That is
for
true
from their mindset and stuff like that. Which is that's a good point for the Laserdisc.
All right, I looked this up. And we've got the nominees and all this stuff and who won. So I want to hear your guys' thoughts on why, like, who won over Aliens, you know, or whatever.
Would have been The Fly.
Actress in a leading role, Sigourney Weaver, was nominated, did not win. Right. She lost to Marley Matlin for Children of the Lesser God.
She did, yeah.
Yeah. Then. Yeah.
Who else was nominated in that year?
Jane Fonda for The Morning After, Sissy Spacek for Crimes of the Heart, and Kathleen Turner for Peggy Sue Got Married. So
Sigourney was clearly the
better choice. Talk about
just the physical. Who are we talking about today? That's all I'm going to say. Okay, it's 35 years later. Anybody want to talk Places in the Heart?
Yeah. So art direction, Aliens was nominated but lost to A Room with a View.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
The other movies that were nominated were Color of Money, Hannah and Her Sisters, and The Mission.
A De Niro film. I was thinking Color of Money. I was like, that was probably going to be up for some of them that year.
The Scorsese film.
Yep. Yeah.
But still, as far as art direction, what had the longest lasting effect? Let's face it, the place they go in Aliens to find the aliens, that ended up in Tim Burton's Batman movie. They use that set again.
I heard that. Yeah, they use that for the toxic site. Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, what was more influential?
They did win some. They did win some, by the way. It's not like, you know, but I am.
I know.
Right now, film editing, they lost to Platoon.
Tune's a great film.
The other ones that were up were Hinner Sisters, The Mission, and Top Gun. So I didn't know. Wow. I forgot Top Gun was 1986.
I did too.
Karate Kid 2. That no Karate
yeah,
Kid.
Yeah, that was that year. Only thing I see Karate Kid 2 was that they were nominated for like Best Original Song. But they didn't win.
Thing I did see with Karate Kid 2 was that Aliens took its spot at number one in the box office from Karate Kid 2. And then Karate Kid 2, I mean, then Aliens replaced by The Fly.
Fly.
Yeah, the summer of 86.
Yeah, it was a good year for horror. China. Yeah, yeah.
It's from the China kid that year, too.
Yeah.
Music, original score, Aliens lost to Round Midnight, done by Herbie Hancock.
Wow. What?
That's a travesty.
The other movies that were nominated were Hoosiers, The Mission.
That's a good score. Damn,
The Mission got a lot of a nomination.
The Mission had a great score.
I've never seen it. I don't even. I didn't.
Ennio Morricone did
that. I need to watch it. Sounds like
The Mission is a beautiful film. It's just not aliens.
And
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, by the way.
That had score. That had a good score. That was Leonard Rosenman did that score. That was a very good score. But Aliens was better.
By the way, so. Yeah. The ones that were nominated for the original songs were Top Gun, Take My Breath Away, The Karate Kid Part 2, Brilliant. Glory of Love, That's Pierce Life, Tariff. Life in a Looking Glass. Let's see, Little Shop of Yeah, that's apparently it's a musical or something. Little Shop of Horrors, another musical. An American Tale.
What won?
Top Gun
had to have won.
Yeah.
Berlin. Yeah.
So let's see. Still now they don't today. Sound. They lost to Platoon. And next to Heartbreak Ridge was nominated. Star Trek IV was nominated.
Yep.
And Top Gun was nominated.
Top Gun. They all had good sound. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sound effects, editing. Aliens won.
One.
Yeah,
deservedly.
And the other nominees were Star Trek IV and Top Gun. Those are the only ones. And then speaking of visual effects, Aliens won again. Obviously.
Those effects what do you guys think? I think the effects held up incredibly well in Alien. Like I watched it a few weeks ago before I even knew I was doing this, and like the troop transport thing. And the effects of the aliens and even the dropship stuff, that looks as good as stuff they're doing now. And that's models.
Mm-hmm.
And so
there was no CG in that movie. There's no CG at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was
the
like,
Queen thinking, was a complete puppet, right? It's a puppet.
Yeah.
It reminded me very much of Jurassic Park, like how I think they modeled. I feel like Steven Spielberg kind of took some stuff from Aliens because like you watch, I was watching it last night going, the Queen reminds me of the freaking Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know?
T-Rex, the way it moves.
The way it moves.
Yeah.
They used
animatronics in Jurassic Park too, which is why the dinosaurs look so good. Yeah. There was less CG and more stuff. You know, I think both of them were made by Stan Winston. Stan Winston really took the Aliens to next level because didn't Cameron work with him on Terminator? He created the Terminator skeleton.
Yeah,
so that started that really long relationship between Cameron and Winston. Winston took the Aliens to next level. And I feel like the Queen design and the look, which I believe Cameron designed the Queen based on H.R. Giger's drawing, the organic feel, it felt like a giant insect. You know, it just moved very fluidly. But what impressed me was like, with our modern eyes now, you know, being so spoiled with CG, which sometimes can look really good, sometimes can look really bad, those effects look amazing. And they're never going to get crappy. Like they're never going to be like Babylon 5, where you're like, what were they thinking? You know, I think they will always hold up because they were physically there.
Yeah.
And I think watching movies now versus, that are dated back there, you can see that. Even if it isn't CG and stuff like that, you know that it seems more real to me. It's like, you're experiencing something that real. Now it's like, it might be visually the top looking thing, but it's like, we know it's like almost all fake. And it's like,
you don't have quite the same reaction to the magic. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I hope that they find a blend of practical. You know, in my own film stuff, I always am like 50% practical because you want to physically feel like it's there. You're in danger. You're touching it or it's there. Because when something doesn't have any weight, you know, it's the difference between the first three Lord of the Rings movies and the Hobbit trilogy. The Hobbit trilogy, the orcs had no weight. The creatures had no weight to them versus the people in the costume being orcs. They felt real.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, our brains cannot be fooled by that.
So I was just going to say the last thing was that the other two that were nominated for visual effects was Little Shop of Horrors and Poltergeist 2, The Other Side. So, but Stan Winston was the one who won for visual effects. But
didn't Geiger do something with Poltergeist 2? I think that's why he wasn't involved with
it. He designed the tequila worm, I think.
Maybe, but Richard Edlund was the visual effects guy. Okay.
He was the head of ILM. Yeah.
Yeah. So
Richard Edlund was ILM.
Yeah. Which isn't that Steven Spielberg or George Lucas's?
George Lucas owned ILM. He started ILM. Yeah. He started in Van Nuys.
Oh, nice. So, where I used to live.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a warehouse. I've been by it many times. A warehouse in Van Nuys. He used to put Death Star stuff out on ping pong tables and run cameras over it. And that's how it started.
Where was it? Like what roads was it on? Do you know? I might have been like right by there.
You probably lived really near it. I'll look it up.
I always like to know that stuff because I'm like, I saw the stuff on ILM on the documentary.
It was on Valjean. The original ILM was on Valjean Avenue in Van Nuys. You know where Valjean is?
No. Yeah.
It's actually just as you're taking the exit off the, let's see, if you go up the 405 and exit, it's in the warehouse district there.
Oh, okay.
So, it's like right off the freeway.
There's something to be said about models and that kind of stuff. When we're talking about CG and actual things you can touch and feel, like some friends and I, we watched on Blade Runner tonight, and then I've been watching Thunderbirds by Gary Anderson. The other models were just so functional. They look, and what's cool about these things, they look lived in. They look like they're used. They don't look like clean.
Yeah, they look like they have a life beyond the movie. And wasn't it Brian Johnson? He did the Eagles in Space 1999, and he ended up doing all the model work in Empire Strikes Back. And he started off doing all the Thunderbird stuff and all the stuff for ITC. Awesome. Yeah, he was a great model maker. Amazing.
It's interesting. I mean, and you'd be out there in California, it's even more so, where it's like some of these sites and stuff like that. It's like where all that stuff has really happened in the past. And I mean, it's like that in a lot of other places, but it's like, I mean, where you are now, it's like there might have been something like right down the street from you, or maybe even on your same block, that something was shot there at some point.
Like Pasadena area, and like I swear to God, I pass by like a million places that I'm like, I think I know that, like, I know of that place from somewhere, you know, and it's such a weird, like, little, like, thing, you know. I think I'm going to try to get some more pictures and stuff. Like, I passed by the school, right? I think it was, like, Arcadia High School or something, or one of those, like, things.
I think we were talking.
Yeah, and I passed by it, and I was with my roommate Jackie, and then we came home that day and we watched Can't Hardly Wait, and it said exactly that, like it said that's cool, and I was like,
you're like, I know that place,
that's freaking awesome, like how that's neat, hilarious. It's such a neat experience, like, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of cool.
Oh yeah, every day I walk by something and you get deja vu. I'll be like, wait, I'm standing where he was in Back to the Future. This is the Burger King that he skated out of Doc Brown's. The first Burger King I ever ate at when I moved to LA, I realized was the one that he skates by when he leaves Doc Brown's house in Back to the Future. I was like, okay, this is freaky. Like, there's so many locations. I drive by the house from Halloween all the time.
Which one?
The original one in Pasadena, the one that shot the first Halloween.
Yeah. I'm gonna go since I'm over there. I'm gonna go. I was supposed to go with a friend, one of my former roommates. I was supposed to go with her, and then she hasn't been able to do anything because of COVID, you know, and everything. So I'm just like, screw it. I gotta go. Like, I gotta see the Michael Myers house, man. Like,
you've got to.
I saw the other ones. I saw them. The Michael Myers, and then I also saw the babysitter ones, the ones that the kids were at, and they were actually right across the street from each other.
Uh-huh.
And then across the street from that was the Nightmare on Elm Street houses. So
that's like, right.
So you saw like the
horror alley right there. Yeah.
That's
like the Doyle house or whatever for Halloween.
Yeah. Is that the Doyle house and was the other one, Lindsay or whatever, Lindsay's house. So like they're right across the street from each other, you know, which makes perfect sense because they're supposed to be right across the street.
Easier to shoot. Yeah, absolutely.
So then I guess Wes Craven was like, I'm going to go and put, you know, Johnny Depp's house and the and Heather Langenkamp's house right, you know, right across the street from there. And that is just insane. So you're able to get like double the dose of horror right there. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing about Aliens that I love is that the blending of horror, like genuine tension, like when the facehugger, spoiler alert, gets loose inside the medical facility and you see it turned over and you know it's crawling around with the little girl trapped in there. He wove in all the great things about horror that you love in the context of a war movie. And it reminded me of those comics you'd read, like Weird War, or all these ones where there's always some supernatural sci-fi angle to a war going on, but I had never seen it in a movie before. And so the whole idea of like, they're in battle, there's this whole tech, but they're fighting non-humans. And then you have like these really tense horror, you know, literal horror scenes in the middle of this war movie just blew my mind. It just blew my mind.
Yeah, like when they get there and they land, there's nothing around. So the tension just starts building. It's raining, so that adds to it. They're like, where the fuck is everybody? Yep. And then they come across Newt and they pick her up with the motion sensors. And it's just that pulsing noise was just like,
yeah, that. Yeah, he used sound really well. There was like ding, ding, ding,
clicking that was on her gun, on Vasquez's gun when she was walking around the scanner thing. You know, just heard that little click, and it was just Vasquez like was a heartbeat. Character too. Vasquez's character was
she's great. Jeanette Goldstein, she's been in she was in Terminator 2. She's the stepmom.
Isn't she? Holy cow! I never even I didn't even put that together.
I auditioned with her one time. I had the greatest conversation with her. She's the nicest lady. And we were sitting there. We were going to go in together for some commercial or something like that. And I was like, you realize you've been in Star Trek, Terminator, Aliens. It's like, what are you doing here? And she's like, hey, I'm just doing my thing. But she just disappears into those roles. And you're like, all right, that's her. You know, she's in a Star Trek movie.
Well,
you know, it's crazy.
She can do conventions for everything. I mean, she can be anytime.
She deserves it. She's just perfect. Yeah,
she was and now that I'm like thinking about it, she had like the greatest like little part where she knocks the guy out with the fucking thing and everything. She's just like, you know, like it's just so simple and easy, like she makes it, and you know that's not easy, you know, it's especially you as an actor. All of us, you know, in the film business, like know that, like we know as actors, like that shit is like, when you can make it look easy like that, you know, it's like more difficult. And so she definitely,
she's in her moment. Yeah. You just think she's just doing her thing. She's just telling the story. Yeah. And again, I think that's to Cameron's credit. He understands casting. He brought back Michael Bain as Hicks, having worked with him in Terminator. He brought in a lot of his, you know, players, like we were talking about Bill Paxton, who was also in Terminator. Jeanette ended up being in a bunch of his films. I think he might be a stern taskmaster as far as being a director, but clearly people respect him because they come back for more. And nobody can tell a pop, you know, a pop genre film the way Cameron does. He gets the tech right. He gets the pacing right. He utterly invests himself in whatever the world is that he's creating. And the thing about Aliens that I love is I believe that these Marines were in over their head. I believe how it would feel to be on a nuclear facility melting down with aliens over my head, and you're in this pressure cooker, and Paul Reiser, this like scumbag kind of capitalist guy, all of those characters all work together to just take it and twist you and twist you and twist you. And that's what Aliens was supposed to do.
Yeah,
you know, he did it beautifully.
And the pressure erupted when I think it was the Dietrich or the medic lady. She comes up, we found one, and she goes, "Kill me!" And she's like, "What the heck?" And Sigourney Weaver, she knows what's going to happen, and she can't tell them. And then the chest pressure comes out, and they're like, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah. It was like next level bad. Yeah. It's like, just kill me. No, we can't kill you. Yeah, we should kill her. Yeah. that was great stuff.
Yeah, that was
we talked a little bit earlier about Bill Paxton. And one of the things that I liked, and you were talking about the swing, watching the momentum change with the Marines and all, you saw how he was arrogant and pompous at the beginning. But he also had the fear, because when with the thing with the knives, so he was like, you could tell he was like arrogant, but yet he was afraid. And then it's like, as the movie shifted, he became like utterly terrified.
Yes. but his bravado was exactly the thing to hide who he really was, which is, I don't want to be here, man. I don't want to be doing this.
He's like, we're going to blow it up, Bill.
Yeah.
We're going to be out here and blow it up.
Jonathan, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, having not seen this movie in for like a while, since I bought it on Blu-ray a few years ago or whatever, I actually really just enjoy just, like you guys had said stuff about the war stuff, because like they get in there and they're kind of told not to like shoot anything like at all or whatever, but like when you're in the midst of that, you know, that situation, and that's all you have is your, you know, your guns and everything, right. You know what I mean, and like you want to get out of there, the military people are kind of taught like, do whatever you know, if you have to disobey an order, if you have to disobey in order to survive, do it, you know, or something, basically, is what they basically had to do. But, you know, and them shooting the stuff never, I don't think really ever affected anything, like, because I guess they were smart about where they shot.
Yeah, the danger was if with live incendiary rounds, you could damage the nuclear reactor. Eventually, the reactor, of course, does overload and overheat by their own plan, that they're just going to basically nuke it. But the danger factor was to show the lack of preparation, where the guy goes, how many jumps have you had? Including the simulation, one. That guy, he had a plan, but the problem is he didn't have the kind of practical experience that the people he was leading didn't have, you know. He just didn't know what he was doing. And then he vapor locks at the video thing, and he becomes kind of a surrogate for the audience, where they're like, wait, we lost camera one, we lost camera three, wait, what's happening now, hang on, let me get a hold of this thing. And finally the guy just freezes, which is actually very believable. Some people get that kind of PTSD and they just can't function. I mean, he's not a bad guy, but he was way over his head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, who would be ready for that though? Encounter? Yeah.
So we haven't talked about Paul Reiser's character at all, which he, like, okay, this was, I think this was pre Mad About You, if I'm correct. I think Mad About You was 1990 something or whatever. So this is pre Mad sure. About You.
I knew him before his stand up.
I knew him from a TV show at the same time that this was, I think that I saw it for the first time. It was a show called My Two Dads. It was a light 80s, late 80s,
right,
early 90s type of comedy. But that's where I remembered him from. And then obviously Mad About You, I mean, he's famous.
Mad About You, I think, was 92. Yeah.
So, what a daring
choice though, to hire a comedian to play the villain.
Yeah.
And he did such a great job. Like, honestly,
so
many times I just wanted to punch him in the face.
I know, the way he said kiddo, whenever he would say kiddo, he's like, look, kiddo, I'm just look, this is there's a certain dollar amount attached to this facility. Yeah. It's like, are you kidding me?
He's just a grud. Look,
kiddo, I know you had a bad day. It's bad. He made a bad call, kiddo. Made a bad call.
And when he basically set her up to get impregnated and everything and all that, and then he's like, you know, this is ridiculous, guys. Like, I would never do that.
Bill Paxton's like, you dog me, pal. He should work for a pharmaceutical company or something, because that guy was such a great character. And he's exactly the guy to be like, yeah, you know that cancer drug? I'm going to make it a $500 a pill. I can't believe this, kiddo. I can't believe you're going to die. Go ahead, finish. No, I was just going to say, I think that being a comedian, he embraced the darker sides of himself, that he uses comedy kind of to be this kind of, you know, approachable, he's Paul Reiser playing the dad. But I think every good comedian has a dark side. And I think Cameron must have seen something in him where he's like, you are a complete cheese ball and instantly unlikable, which is what you want, because you actually are rooting for the aliens at the end when he's hiding in the back room.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the scene, the scene we talked about earlier that with Sigourney Weaver, that probably would have won the Oscar if they would have left it in the original version. Reiser was in that scene too, because he wasn't going to tell her about her daughter being gone, because he had a self-serving interest to get her to go along. So it's like seeing that after we know what his character's like. So going back and seeing that gives a whole different context to his character too, because it shows at the beginning that he's willing to withhold information from of a family member's death, basically.
Yeah.
For his own personal interests. Yeah. So it was just, So that scene worked well for him too as a supporting character, yeah. Obviously, much lesser.
I agree. And I love the, did IQs just drop sharply while I was saying, yeah. It's like, there's so many, it is an indictment of the kind of groupthink of a corporation where people become these kind of anonymous things and make these decisions where it's like, well, look, there's, you know, money to be made and who may, you know, the colonists, we're going to do this. And it's like, well, they're in danger. Yeah. But there's a significant dollar amount, you know, and that was kind of ahead of its time. Like, remember, this is pre Enron, pre all the yep. problems that we've had with financial things. This prefigured that. This was in the middle of the 80s that he was saying companies without any kind of moral tether whatsoever absolutely would terraform a planet they knew to be dangerous and say, look, those are the breaks. We lose 2/3 of the colonists, you know, and in a group of people, people will do things immorally that they wouldn't do just as human beings. They well, the board voted, we're going out there. It's like, are you serious?
And then you know, Ripley, and then Ripley at the end of it just told him, bill me for the
bill me.
That was the best line.
Bill me. Yeah, you can bill me.
I'll just ask this question because maybe you guys know, because you guys are probably more into aliens than obviously I am. But like I want to be. I'm gonna start like watching more, especially since they're on HBO Max and people can just like, you know, binge watch them or whatever. When like what year is this supposed to be? Like because like she was asleep right for a while. And she
slept several decades.
Right. Yeah,
I think she said 57 years after the first movie.
Okay. So
old enough for her daughter to have passed away of old age.
Right. Yeah,
her daughter passed away like at 65 or 66, something like that. The last
time she saw her daughter, the daughter was 11 years old, is what she said. So was she up in space before then? Because like 11 years old plus 57, that's 69. Or 68.
Yeah, correct.
68.
So like, yeah.
68 years old. They showed a picture of her, of the daughter now, like, but right before she passed away. That lady looked 80 or so.
Yeah, it was her
like
mom. That, yeah.
Or, that's her. That was her real life mom.
It was her mom playing her.
It was like an inside joke. But yeah. Jonathan, this is not without precedent. Even today, somebody that does oil rigs or people that do the deep sea fishing out in Alaska, they'll go make a run or they'll do some deep sea drilling and they'll go for a year or two for their family and the company takes care of their family and then they'll come back. She was on a mining mission in Alien. And that mission was to be several years, but it would have taken care of her and her kid for the remainder. Right. And when she destroyed that ore, that's when she became accountable. But also she was never supposed to be in cryosleep longer than 2 or 3 years. So what happened was when she went into the escape pod, there wasn't a flight plan laid in because the alien was had stowed on board. Remember, and she has to confront the alien. So she put herself into cryo without a flight plan. So a salvage team happened to find her. She would never have been found if that salvage team hadn't found her. So there was never a practical thing where you would be away from your family that long.
Right. Well, yeah. I was just trying to get a grip of like how, like what year like this was supposed to take place. Like,
they say the whole series takes place between like the 21st and 24th type of century overall. And I think the first Alien is, and then goes 57 years in the future for the second one. Third one picks up right after the second one.
Yeah,
and then the fourth one's like 100 years after that.
So it's a bigger jump.
Yeah. Then Prometheus and Alien Covenant take place before Alien.
Right.
Well, it's really funny because if you look at Ridley Scott did Blade Runner and, you know, all that, like every time you look at Blade Runner, it's supposed to take place, you know, further in the future. All the technology and the computers definitely don't look like they do now, you know, or whatever. Like some maybe a little bit, but not really.
Right. A lot of it was prophetic. We don't have flying cars, but we do have a lot of the tech that has come out of Blade. You know, we can search through photos in 3D now and map through them, and we can do a lot of things. And we don't have replicants and things, but there is a shared shot between Alien and Blade Runner. Did you know that? There's an exact shot in both. In both ones, do you know what it is, Jonathan?
No, I'm interested to hear this.
The spinner, when he does the steam purge and first lifts off when he's leaving with Gaff, it shows a particular graphic on a display. That exact graphic is on the purge display when the Nostromo is landing on the planet for the to find the alien. It's the exact same graphic. It's the same shot.
Wow. Now I'm going to go back and watch that again. I mean,
yeah,
I
just saw it's Blade buried
earlier,
in there.
Earlier this month, for the first time in years. So
you watch that. Watch for that shot, because the graphic of when the spinner's taking off and it does a kind of grid with a little circular graphic. That exact graphic is the Nostromo landing on the other planet. And of course, the implication is this shared tech? Is this the off-world colonies that they're speaking of in Blade Runner? But I thought it was a really cool, subtle thing that Ridley did. It's only one shot, but it links the two.
Well, it's funny, and I'm going to mention this real quick, James Cameron, you know, taking over for Aliens, had the Hyperdyne systems, you know, mm-hmm. which sounds very similar to Cyberdyne systems.
Exactly, Cyberdyne
and
systems.
I'm wondering if, you know, if he's trying, if somehow or another they're trying to connect, you know, Terminator to a little bit to Aliens as well. So I would love to see, this is crazy, but I would love to, and I've seen, like, I think there's comics like this, but I would love to see Aliens versus Terminator sometime. Like,
oh,
I think
that would be amazing. Yeah.
I don't know if that's possible because of production companies and whatever.
I think, like, they had a trifecta with Aliens versus Predator versus Terminator.
There you go. That, just take my money. And it has to be done by Cameron.
Yeah, exactly. Problem is, Cameron's too busy with his Avatar movies for the next, like,
yep. He's going to be busy for 10 years. Yeah,
that's the rest of it. That's the 12 or something. Yeah, he's doing like 2, 3, 4, and 5 all together or something.
Two and three are done. They're in the can. Yeah. And depending on how they do, he's going to do 4 and 5. But 2 and 3 actually have the most patents ever issued for a film, the most technical patents, because he invented a new 3D underwater rig that shoots true 3D at deep ocean depth. He actually staged scenes in the ocean in 3D. So, yeah, it has the most patents, though. So he apparently invented a bathysphere that can shoot in 3D. Pretty cool. Yeah,
you'd be surprised that this is the same guy that did Titanic. it's just like Titanic.
He wanted to make the ultimate chick flick where you sink a ship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were touching on earlier about all the stuff that all the people he works with and stuff like that repeatedly, and I mean, and then you got Sigourney Weaver coming with Avatar.
There's a relationship of respect there. And you can tell, because if somebody comes back and does multiple films, then there's something that they see in each other where it's like, okay, you've got my back. You know, yeah. I know I'm going to do a good job with you, or at least I enjoy spending all the time I have to do to make this story. And certainly with him, he's like, look, you're a quality person. I want to work with you acting wise. I know you can deliver on what I want. And so he just works with people he can talk shorthand to.
Right.
I'm sure he and Sigourney can look at each other. And he's like, remember that thing you did with the alien thing and thing to do that? Yeah. Okay. And then they just go.
Well, you know, I heard good things. Like, I heard that when Sigourney Weaver got the script for Aliens, right? James Cameron thought she would have like a ton of notes about the story, but all she had was notes about like what she thinks Ripley would do. You know, like as far as like emotional stuff or how she would react and how she would do. So those are the only notes. And she said she completely respected him as a writer. And so did this other the guy who, one of the producers of Alien and then obviously Aliens, said that, you know, when they read the Terminator, they were like, we want this guy for Aliens, because he, you know, obviously understands sci-fi well enough, you know, and everything. He's really good. And I agree. Like, I think Terminator is probably the best, you know, like script.
That's a tight. Yeah. I mean, you think about it, it was only made for $8 million and he made it every cent on the screen. And Terminator actually got delayed because Schwarzenegger had the second Conan the Destroyer coming out. And so since he knew it was delayed, he used that 6 months to write Alien 2. And he had two typewriters. He had one typewriter, which had Rambo 2. And when he ran out of ideas on Alien, he would work on Rambo. And then he would write Aliens. And then he handed both scripts in at the same time. And they told him, if Terminator does well, you can do Aliens 2. So he's like, great, no pressure. So he waited to see Terminator open. It opened. Everybody loved it. And they go, okay, now you can make it. But he wrote that not knowing he'd be able to make the film.
Oh, that's nice. Though. Yeah. I mean,
but yeah, you can imagine it's like sitting here typing Rambo 2 and then writing Aliens 2 and then hoping one of them goes.
I think honestly, after seeing Rambo, like all the Rambo movies recently too, I'm one of those people, I'm late on everything, you know? So like I watched,
did you see First Blood, the original one? It's actually quite obviously. Good.
Yeah. I really liked First Blood, but it's so different. Like,
I mean, that was the original book more closely. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm glad they didn't, like, James Cameron didn't decide to make, you know, Rambo be another, just have another PTSD. He did the same exact thing that he did for, now you're making me start thinking that maybe that was what he did, because like maybe when he's writing both of them at the same time, he kind of did the same exact thing. It's like, he's like, all right, let's make a war movie out of Alien.
Yeah.
Right. And let's make a war
movie. That may have been his process
out of Rambo. And
influence. Yeah.
And so both of them were war movies, you know, that both movies originally were not war movies in a way, like even though First Blood was, you know, had him in the jungle fighting everybody, it was not technically a war movie. It was a terrorist movie. He was a, you know, at that time, he was kind of acting like a terrorist in this town, you know, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it's so funny that
It may have been his headspace where he was feeling creative and one cool. went like, to the other. Yeah.
What's funny is I hadn't seen Rambo in a number of years, the older ones. And it was given to me a gift for Christmas, a Blu-ray of all five of them together in a Blu-ray set. So I watched the first one a couple weeks ago, and I have to watch the other ones now. Because, I mean, I haven't seen
Brian Dennehy in
forever.
Wow, he was Brian great. Dennehy. Him sitting in the car, and he's like, so you're going to leave, right? You're just passing through. You realize this guy is so – he's going to just so mess with him. He's like, no, man, come on, friend. Come on in. No. And then you're going to take off, right? You're leaving. I'll take you to the end of the – you want me to take you out now? It's such a great character. He's so good.
Yeah, and he has such a presence too, because he was such a hulking guy.
It was just he was. He was a bear of a guy, and he had a lot going on in his eyes. I always loved his stuff, whether he was in a Western or whatever, but you utterly believed what he was doing. You know, he meant it.
Yeah.
You know, go
ahead.
I was just going to say, I think with Aliens, one thing we take for granted is that each one of those characters was so well-defined that Cameron made us care about the ones that got hit with acid or the ones that died. You felt the deaths, you know, from the sergeant to Vasquez to all these different people. He made them have their little hero moments and their little sacrifices, but we met them when they were waking up and they each had their little thing, you know I guess he didn't like cornbread either, you know, kind of thing. There's all these little moments that make you care, and I think so many films miss that. Like you want to tell a director or writer who's making a film, you want to go, you know what, it's enough to have the spectacle, sure, but if you make us feel and care about each death on a more intimate level, it becomes less anonymous and it becomes more emotional. Because it's like the news, when you hear like, oh, 1,000 people died, well, if you don't know them personally, you don't feel it the same way, as you go, oh my God, Vasquez is like hanging on to a grenade and she's gonna die, you know. And it's not anonymous.
I was gonna say
In the magic of this movie was you put like 10 or 12 or the core people, and they each had their own individual characteristics, but it wasn't. And that's a very delicate thing to write with, because it's like you got to be able to get that person's in like a couple lines, basically who they are. But yet, so when they do get killed, that you feel it. I mean, Lance Henriksen's character, the android.
He's terrific.
Yeah, and it's like you have the android aspect from the first one that Sigourney Weaver, that Ripley was dealing with, and then it's like in this one, it's like oh man, when's he going to turn, or what is he going to turn, and stuff like that.
Yes.
Then he doesn't, but then it's like he helps get all the way to the end, then he gets ripped in half, and it's like
and the look of surprise on his face where he's like, he realizes something's wrong, or he's very childlike where he's like, oh, I would never hurt anybody, you know, after he does the knife trick. And he's like, we don't do that. We have protocols. That's a tribute to Lance just getting into the headspace of the childlike quality of, you know, he's a synthetic and he's there to help people, but he's a victim of the prejudice from what happened with the last mission. Exactly. He's like, I know everybody freaking hates me, but all I'm trying to do is help you people.
Well, you know? And I want to go back to, you were saying that basically you need to get people who you all, you know, love and you cheer for, and you want these guys to like survive and everything. But movies today, especially horror films, today mostly, they get so annoying characters that you just want all of them to die. So they're all like Burke, except Burke is such a great slime ball character. You know, you really right. like him, but you want right. him to die, right?
Right.
But these characters are just, like most characters, are just annoying, you know? And none of these characters were annoying. Not, no. you know, you care for every single one. The only ones I didn't really like either way were a lot of the people that just kind of died off screen that you never really, you know, because all this stuff's happening. All of a sudden they're like, we lost this guy. We lost that guy. Like Frost. I don't even remember who that person was.
Oh, he got crisp. He got burnt. That right. was funny.
Frost is the one who likes Vasquez, and he gets the acid across him.
Oh, okay.
Big guy.
And then
that was Drake.
Yeah.
Drake got the acid. Frost was the acid. What are we going to use? Harsh language?
That's right. Drake. Yes, that's okay. right. That's right.
So, yeah. So, like, all of these guys, like, there's so many of them, right? Like, there's a whole, basically a whole platoon, you know, to go back to platoon being, you know, nominated for like a million things. Right. Like, there's a whole platoon of people like that you have to get to know and everything. And it's tough. As a writer, like, a lot of times you have to be... And I can't imagine writing on a typewriter because, like, I like fucking.
I can.
I can't. No, I'm so glad.
I don't have to imagine it. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you mess up a page, you got to retype.
Right. Exactly. So, like, but you have to be, like, all, like, very, condense everything so that everything is specific to that character, right? So, is there, right. you know, you and I definitely know this for a fact, being writers. I don't know. Alfred, I know you write some stuff too and everything. And so do you, Joe, right? Like you've written mm-hmm. Scripts. Yes. So when you write dialogue or you write the characters, it's got to be specific to the story, right? You've got to actually make sure that each scene is, you know, like leads to the next and sets up for the whole rest of it, right? And so I think
the most important thing, I mean, when I'm writing is you have to make sure that all the characters don't speak in your voice, is right. that they speak in their own voice. And I think, you know, you're in the pocket when the characters begin to dictate to you. They tell you what they would say and what they wouldn't say. And you're basically catching stuff out of the ether and you're taking the conversation you're hearing in your head and you're just taking dictation at that point because the characters are so clearly delineated that you'd be like, Burke wouldn't say that. And then you change it. And then you start to hear what Burke would say to her and you didn't even know he was going to say it. And when I'm writing a feature right now where literally this character of Kevin, I was like, Kevin wouldn't say that. And then I listened for a little while and I heard what he would say and I wrote that in and it was absolutely perfect. And I think when you're in the pocket writing a script like that, you're really taking dictation from the characters. If you've done mm-hmm. your homework and you understand what makes them tick, it will feel, it's like music. When a note's off, you know it. You know, it's like, that's not the right note. He wouldn't say it that way or she wouldn't do that. And one thing that Cameron did really well in Aliens is everyone was on point with the musicality of their character in that you understood each one of them. They all worked together and you felt their loss if their voice went away, but also they sounded like Marines and she sounded like a pissed off miner who didn't want to go there. And Paul Reiser sounded like the cheese ball and they were all true to their own character and no line was wasted. Everything they said advanced the plot, but also revealed character. Him saying kiddo in one word makes you go, oh, you know, this guy.
I
was like, look, kiddo, it was a bad call, you know, and that's all he had to say. And to me, that's beautiful writing because when you can't see what they're doing and you take it for granted, that means they've done their job. You know, mm-hmm. it's like watching a movie and go, that guy's not doing anything. He's just being John Wayne, mm-hmm. you know, and that is the beauty and magic of the movie is that we just can enjoy it and we don't see the process. You don't see the wires manipulating it. You just go, well, that's Hicks. Somebody wake up Hicks. Hicks is asleep on the drop ship. That is all you need to know. This is mm-hmm. this guy's so cool. You could keep meat on him for a week. That's how cool he is, you know, and he's like, somebody wake up Hicks. And you know you're going to like that guy. And mm-hmm. and they call that a save the cat moment. Are you familiar with the save the cat moment in the script? Okay. Well, in the 30s, in order for you to like a character like Jimmy Stewart, every screenwriter always had a moment where a character, regardless of his shading of a good person, bad person, if you were on his side, there was a moment where he'd be talking and Jimmy would be like, well, you know, the thing is, I want to do this thing. And he'd stop for a second and he'd find a cat. He'd be like, well, there's a cat up here in the tree. I'm just going to take that down and put the cat there. And the audience is like, I like this guy. He's kind of an asshole, but I like him. And he saves the cat. And then he continues with what he's doing. But in a script, psychologically, it aligns you with that person right away. And there's always a save the cat moment inside of a script where you're with Sigourney. Sigourney at first is a little unapproachable because when she wakes up or she does whatever. But by the time she's in that boardroom meeting and she's like, look, you idiots, you know, the IQs drop sharply and do all this thing. And then you see she has this moment with her daughter. You like her. That's her save the cat moment. And you'll follow her anywhere. And it's so important to create empathy, because if you're doing a horror movie or you're doing a war movie, it can't just be about the physicality of the spectacle, because after a while we get numb to death and after a while we get numb to tension. But if we have an emotional stake in it, because we've seen this person save a cat, we like this person, then you're going to follow them anywhere and you'll feel when they're hurt, you're hurt.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
There you go.
Dave the cat. There you go.
Yeah, there's a...
You have that book?
I have the book, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's a great book.
It's a fantastic book. It's one of my favorites, screenwriting book. It's basically, it tells you not just the save the cat stuff, but also how to write, like, you know.
Yeah,
the,
I read it regularly. I read it right before I started this thing because it helps me do a template of where I want things to happen in it. And I thought that save the cat moment, I've seen it in Jimmy Stewart movies, old Jimmy Stewart movies. They used to do stuff like that. And it was beautiful because it was a very simple thing, but it made you love the guy.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up now. It's been over an hour, but I appreciate this has been an awesome, like we could probably talk for like hours on this.
I love this talking movie. To you guys. You have such great insights and I love talking to people that love movies too, because movies are just amazing. They are literally like we're sharing a dream.
Exactly.
I have to say this movie is probably a perfect movie.
I would agree with you.
Yeah, I had to agree. I've been looking. I got to see the first Alien on the big screen earlier this year because AMC is bringing a lot of the old stuff back, and they keep having Aliens listed, but they haven't put it out here yet. I'm like, if they did, I'm there. See it on the big screen.
You
like,
gotta go. Yeah, gotta go.
Even if they put it out tomorrow, I just watched it last night again. I'll be like, I'm there. I gotta see.
Yeah,
gotta
see it on the big screen. I agree with you. That's I'm going to show you this.
Oh, go ahead.
This is that shared. Sorry to interrupt there. This is the shared. Let me show you this. Hang on. Can you guys see that? That's the environmental purge. That's in Blade Runner and in Alien. You see that?
Wait, no, we're seeing. It's showing your back.
Let me turn off my virtual background here for a second. That's the beauty of this thing. Here we go. Okay, check it out. See that?
Oh, yeah.
That is in both movies.
Oh, cool.
I'm going to put Blade Runner back on for that.
I know. That's got to be like a double feature right there.
Yeah, that is the shared universe thing.
Yeah. So are they trying to say that really Scott's like all his movies are shared in the same universe?
Basically. He at least put some little hint in there of something going on, to be sure. Yeah, something going on.
I like to say that the Lifetime movies that I did background on, they're all shared universe, because I'll be like, my character was in this scene and this scene, you know, right? And it's the same guy that's in every single one of these.
you're finding the you're finding his motivation.
I was Mark the bartender in one, and then
so why is he bartender?
That's hilarious.
The Mark the bartender was at a wake in another movie, and then he was, you know, right?
You're so, part of the HLU, the Hallmark Lifetime universe.
That's right. Hallmark, yeah. They have their own exactly. MCU style universe.
The HLU, the Hallmark Lifetime Hallmark universe.
Lifetime universe. I
like
that.
It. I like it. The HLU. I appreciate that. So thank you guys so much. Tom, tell us a little bit about what you've been up to.
Let's see. I just filmed something in Atlanta, which will be coming out next year. I have a radio show out with the Mindstream Players. We have a funny version of Ebenezer Scrooge we did, and Dracula, which you can look for. I have a horror movie out called The Noise in the Middle, which is on Amazon and I think iTunes and Google Play. And then I have a film noir that I wrote and directed called Trouble Is My Business, which is out everywhere. So check some of those things out. And I have some new projects coming up.
You just gave me a great idea, like a Christmas Carol, sure, but with Dracula. Like that would that would be freaking hilarious.
That would be amazing.
You know, like he's visited by the ghosts of Christmas past or whatever, the ghosts, yeah, of like, you know, and victims past, present and future, you know, or something.
You know, Bill Lugosi, Christopher Lee, and yeah, Jack Balance.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
That'd check out fun, some of that stuff. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so how can people reach you? Do you have like a website or anything like that?
Yeah, you can reach me on Twitter at Tom Conkle, K-O-N-K-L-E. You can find the film at troubleismy.biz, B-I-Z, troubleismybiz. And the production company is luminactus.com.
Awesome. What about you, Joe? What have you been up to?
Well, I've been working with you on some stuff, doing the, some breakdowns on some idea, some stuff that we're going to be shooting very soon. And I'm working on a few ideas of my own that I'll ultimately be sharing. And, also, been thinking about what, for this podcast, we're going to be doing, the next one, it's going to be a topic. It's going to be a little bit different than the last two. We've done a couple sci-fi movies, some great sci-fi horror films between, The Thing and Alien. So now it's, I'm going to switch it up a little bit. We're going to go a little comedy.
Interesting.
Nice. Well, good.
That sounds great.
Yeah. It's funny, Tom. So we're shooting a couple short films, and Joe and Alfred are both acting in
fantastic
one of them together.
That's great.
And then we are, and then we're finishing that up. So, and Joe's our AD. You know, / line producer.
Oh, nice.
You know, I'm looking forward to seeing it. Yeah, I'll send it to you, definitely. Alfred, what have you been up to?
Well, we're continuing our performance enhancing films podcast, where we invite or interview actors and comedians and people in movies that inspire their performances and draw from. We interviewed Jonathan back in December. His should be coming up pretty soon, in the next week or so. We just started.
Can we say what we did? Or no?
Yeah. Yeah. We did Ed Wood. You picked Ed Wood.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Ed Wood. Yeah. We had a fun conversation. I enjoyed your co-host on that, because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Matt's a great guy. We're both active at the Push Comedy Theater in Norfolk, Virginia. It's an improv comedy place, and a lot of us are students there. And I have a Charged Particles sketch comedy team. You can find us on YouTube. I've been doing a lot of earprov. If you go to earprov.com, they have shows every Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 p.m. I'll be in a poetry jam tomorrow night. And I've also kicking off our new Star Trek podcast, where I got the idea. One of our friends, she is in her 20s, and during the pandemic, she just decided to watch all the Star Treks. So she's watched all of them. We are, our other friend, Tripp, he started watching Star Trek in the 90s, or 2000s in college, and I started watching them in syndication in the 70s. So we got three generations of people growing up with Star Trek, and we're talking about how we view it across the generations.
Oh, that's interesting. I would like to hear that. Yeah,
definitely. Well, thank you guys so much. This has been awesome. We've got a lot of stuff going on with Indie Film Cafe, so a lot of podcasts going on. This isn't the only one. Also, we got a lot of vidcasts going on with Quick Review Thursday and a bunch of different stuff. Indie Film Cafe spotlights. We've got a really big guest hopefully coming on very soon for that one. So we just interviewed Joe Estevez, so that was fun.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, he's a great guy. It was funny, he actually grew up where I'm living, so he, you know, was around there. So it was so weird. You know, it's so fun to talk to people that live in LA, because, you know, when you can just, you know, we've talked about it earlier, that you could just mention all the things that people already, like, you know, like have seen or so and everything. LA's so big yet so small. You don't really think about it like that, but it really is.
Hey, Jonathan, I have one more thing I wanted to add.
Sure.
I'm also doing my first film acting. They have this thing at the comedy theater called the 666 Festival, and it's usually, before the pandemic, it was a stage production of six original scripts perform with six actors, with six directors, and they would do perform these on stage. Well, this year, because of the pandemic, we did short films, and I'm going to be in like three or four of them. I did one, my first voiceover work and my first acting in a film. So those will be coming out probably by the fall. But we're it's kind of exciting to be a part of the short scripts.
Yeah.
And then you'll be in mine. So you'll have, yes, you'll have plenty to put in your reel, you know.
That's great.
You know, and everything.
And keep me informed. I want to see those, okay?
Yeah.
I will, Tom.
Yeah,
definitely.
Thank you.
Are you guys all friends on Facebook or no?
I believe so, yes.
I honestly don't. I think we are, yeah. I think we are from the last time we were together. Yeah.
I think, yeah.
I'll double check for me on my side, see if we're all.
Because we did Jaws, I guess, on the last, like our last.
I think when we did Jaws, we all did. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you guys so much. Stay on the line if you guys can. I'm about to say goodbye. So, bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
You're listening to the Hollywood Boulevard podcast.
Start introducing Alfred.
Who put you in charge?